This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Also sponsored by Windstar Farm. Now here's Jude Feld.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show that trainers listen to. Trainer Talk, sponsored by Fasig Tipton. This is Jude Feld in Horse Racing Radio Network's Lexington, Kentucky studio, and tonight's very special guest is a man I've known for over 30 years. He's lived the ups and downs of our sport and is one of the select few people who can answer, "Yes, I have," to the question most often asked by the racing public, "Did you ever win the Kentucky Derby?" I am pleased and honored to have David Seacross Jr. with me for the hour. Welcome to Trainer Talk, David.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jude. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
That's the question, right? In bars and airports, whenever somebody finds out that you're a horse trainer, did you win the Kentucky Derby?
That's pretty well the first one thing they ask you, yeah. It's pretty nice when you can say yes. You know, it took a long time to do it, but just one, you know, it's one of those things.
Yeah, well, you had a great career, 328 winners, 1,151 times in the money, $8.7 million in purses, you know, but the crowning achievement, the thing that everybody wants to do is to win the Derby, and of course, Sonny's Halo provided you with that moment.
Yeah, and it's kind of nice when you go in there and you're the favorite and win it, you know, because it's not like you're going in there with something that's some piece of garbage that's 100-1 or something that helps a stagger down there. It's not the same feeling as when you run the best horse. And I think I've always thought in all my life that you have to have the best horse to win the Derby. And of course, you've got to be lucky that day too. And you've got to, you know, you just got to get all the breaks that day. And but you've got to still be the best horse pretty well. I mean, I know that there's the mind that birds and horses like that that have, you know, have got down there, that got pretty lucky to win it, that, you know, maybe you shouldn't have. And I guess there's some that have won it that shouldn't have too. But when you run, when you're the favorite and you win it, then you know that you've done the right thing that day, and you've run the best horse, and you've probably done the best job getting the horse there too.
Yeah, the preparation is so important.
I think so too. And for me that year, of course, it just fell into everything. It didn't look that good going into it, a few months out, but going into it, from the Rebel to the Arkansas Derby, from the Arkansas Derby to the Kentucky Derby, it couldn't be better, because it fell on me every 3 weeks. That it was just like 21 days apart each race, and it just came as a. I'll tell you what it was like. It was in the going in the Derby that year, which unless you had the gods were against you, it was like running a 20,000-dollar claimer for 6,000 or 8,000 or 8,000 or something in Narragansett. That's how, you know, I had a very good feeling going into it, and everything just fell into place. And I think I was very fortunate, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's
with it coming like that.
It's a great feeling when you feel like you got the best horse in the race, and then you just have to wait for racing luck to take over. So we're going to talk a lot about Sonny's Halo in the second half of the show, but we want to talk about you a little bit and you know, how you got in the sport. What drew you to horse racing in the first place?
A little bit. I guess my older brother. We were brought up at a place called Willows Park Racetrack in Victoria, B.C., Victoria, British Columbia, right on the west coast. You couldn't get any farther west than stepping out into the Straits of Juan de Fuca, you know. And everybody was, like, where I went to school, we lived right outside the gate there at the racetrack, and the war was on at that time, and, you know, there wasn't much to do. You know, you didn't have a father, there was all single mothers pretty well at the time, because everybody was away at war, and my brothers were there at the track, my two older brothers, and they were 10 years older than I was, I guess, 9 or 10 years older than I was. And then they went into the service. One went into the Coast Guard, and the other went into the Army. And in the middle of the war, when they were of age, just as they reached 18 or 17, I think one was 17 when he went in. And then, of course, then myself and the kids I went to school with, we were all at the racetrack. We'd be down there walking horses and stuff like that in bed and stalls because they'd have a two-week meeting over there in the fall of the year in September. We had short meets those days. They never started until it got like up there, Seattle and Vancouver. And we'd run, I think it started in June 27th or June 17th when the races would start. So the horses would still be turned out until it. I mean, they're turned out most of the year. You know, actually, they wouldn't start training. We'd start training there around March, though, I guess we'd start, and then things would start popping. And it would have about 600 horses, and there was a man down there who had a riding academy called Don Carley, and he had a few thoroughbreds. He had about 7 or 8 thoroughbreds. It's a funny thing. Even to this day, I remember the horses because he used to put me on them when I was a little kid. I was about 8 years old or 9, I guess, right? This was the middle of the war, right? About the 43 or 44, 43, I guess it was. And I'd get on them. He'd put a check line on them. He'd put a tie down on them. It was like a rubber affair thing. It would run right from the noseband, bottom of the noseband, right down to the breastplate. And it would keep the horse's head bowed. It's like you'd see those horses in the circus where they have a little monkey on them, you know, on their back. And they'd take me into this big cattle barn. And I didn't know anything. I'd be about 8, I guess. And I used to go down there first thing in the morning before I'd go to school. I'd run down there and then run to school. And I'd go there. And they'd put me on about 2 or 3. And I remember the My Jury and Some Turley and Teddy B. And just it's funny how you remember those old names. I can't remember something that happened yesterday now, but I can remember the horses I used to get on as a kid. And I was small and everything like that. I didn't weigh but about 60 pounds, I guess. And go down there, it's like the kids in, you know, down in Louisiana and the bayou and places like that, you know, Delahousies and the rest of them that started riding, you know, the short liners and that one, and they'd be so be young. Of course, they don't have that thing now. I guess, you know, it's the odd jockey school like the one that Chris has or Chris McCarron has, and the odd one. I think there's one in Canada too, and Olds, Alberta or something. I think they have one there now, but at that time they didn't have nothing, so they just put you right on horses. And you'd jack your irons up. You'd have 6 or 7 inch irons, you know, and you'd look like one of the little monkeys actually sitting on them, and you'd be going around the cattle barn. I had this path to fall around this big, long barn, and, you know, you get going pretty good, but you just sit there and put a thick cross on them and pop it a pup, and away you go, and I'd do 2 or 3 in the morning before I go to school, then run down and go to school, get out at 3 o'clock, and wham, I'd run back there, and I'd get on, you know, 4, 5, or 6 or something at nighttime there and be still at 6 or 7 o'clock at night. It wasn't just myself. I mean, there was other kids, all of us. And, of course, it was just everything was horse, you know. And you'd take care of them and you'd do this and do that and stagger down the shed with big water pails, you know, one on each end because you would never, no such a thing as hoses. You know, there was never a hose those days. Everything that you did was, everything had to be filled up, the water pails had to be filled up. Everything was tin, so everything was, or metal, so everything was heavy. It wasn't like they were rubber or the plastic like they have nowadays. And you'd stagger down the shed with them and then get in there and do the stalls. We'd have, everything was bedded on straw, so it was, you know, deep, and there'd all be 2-3 feet of straw there and bank them outside and everything. Like, that's where I got a kick out of because... You know, you remember, because naturally, remember when Lucas, everybody was so fabulous with Lucas because he had the stalls out in front, he had banked, he put the big mattresses out in front of the stalls, you know,
yeah,
with the
straw. Yeah, the big pillows of straw out in front, everybody loved that. Yeah,
yeah, right. Well, Twig Branch and I, we were doing that in Phoenix when we were kids at the old fairgrounds and at Sportsman's Park because they'd have these ridges, they built all the barns out of, they'd blow them on with cement, and they had these metal ridges all over them. They would throw them up like swimming pools. They'd get these hoses out and fill them up, you know, and blow the cement on there. We watched them when they built Turf Paradise because we were still at the fairgrounds in Six Points of town in those days. And so we were sitting there one day, and every time you bring a horse out, they'd just step on this ridge or they'd stumble over there. You had to be so careful getting them out because all they had to do was step on there and hurt themselves pretty good. God damn, we got to do something about this. So we'd get straw and we'd shake straw out there, and then, you know, we'd start banking it, and pretty soon we'd have 3 feet of straw out in front, and it was hard to even get them out of there after a while. But we we were doing, and that was in 1956, because Turf Paradise opened up in 56, and I think we were doing it then, and everybody thought we were crazy. But, you know, we were buying straw for about a dollar a bale for 175-pound bales of straw, and, you know, you'd have to drag them down the shed. There was no way you could even lift them. And so when he came up with it, he said, oh, yeah, he says, yep, you started this or something. I thought, that was Wayne. He says, we were kids. We were doing that when Twig and I were, 17, 18 years old. We just started training horses, you know. And then, so it always, just something like that seemed funny to me then. And now you look back at it, you say, you know, I mean, of course, we did other things, too, that you wouldn't dare do now.
Yeah, no, it's...
or you couldn't, that's for sure.
It's crazy. I mean, you basically had a full-time job. You're getting up in the morning, you're going and getting on three horses at 8 years old, you're rushing to school, you're in school all day, you go back to the barn, you get on six or seven more before you have dinner, and then you got to do your homework and go to bed. I mean, you know, child labor laws aside, that's like, that's a tough task.
That, we all had contracts, too. And I remember my contract, and I had it for years and years and years, and you know it got lost through the years, but it had faded. It even turned brown, the paper and everything like that on it. But my first contract was made up by Carl Schillings, who used to be the steward at Tijuana, at Caliente, and a man called Edie Adams. And my contract was made up, and people don't believe this day, and I say it, and if that'd be somebody that's my age or older, if that's possible, to know that that's the truth. But I mean, they talk about slavery and this and that and how bad people had it and blah 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 and everything like that. Well, I'll tell you, there was nobody who had it worse than kids at the racetrack in those days, because the contract employers had you, and they'd look at you, and the first thing they'd do is, if you look like you're going to get too big, they'll start you riding. Like I rode my first race when I was 15. You know, well, I know that they rode bushes, you know, down the bush, but I rode my first race, and they found out my age, and they set me down, and they wouldn't let me ride the rest of the year. That was 1950 or 1951, whatever it was. And then I started the next year. And by that time, I was starting to get big, so I only lasted a couple of years, you know. But anyways, we started off, my contract started off at $15 a month the first year, $20 the second, $35 the third, $50 the fourth, $75 the fifth year. So what they'd do, they'd start you off. If you look like you're going to get too big, the first thing they'd do is look at your hands and your feet. And if you look like you won't get big, they'd start you early. They'd get you a phony birth certificate. We used to get them in San Francisco. Get a phony birth certificate, and away we'd go. So sometimes, I think Alan Jack and a couple of those kids that I rode with, I think they were around 14. I was 15 when I got started because I broke my back. And so I was out. I couldn't ride until I was 14, so I think I was 15 when I started, and as I say, some of those kids up in Canada, they were riding races when they were 14 years old. They started 14, and, you know, they were old riders by the time they were 18. When we'd walk in a room and you see somebody that was 22 or 23, you wouldn't believe it. You called them an old man because, you know, you didn't last that long either, you know, because you got so big. The structure of the kids in North America, like the United States and Canada, are much bigger than, you know. That's why you've got now all your Latin American riders pretty well. Everybody's from down, you know, Mexico or Panama or someplace now, because they just don't, you know, they just don't make them in North America anymore. You know, you can look down the entries now and there'll be 12 names that you can hardly pronounce.
Yeah.
So it's a different game. And of course, there's no more contracts, and it's probably the best thing in the world, because I think they bought me a pair of women's rubber boots to gallop horses in. I never had any boots or anything like that. And then I think they bought me a pair of Levi's, a pair of jeans, and that was it. And I had the contract for 3 years before I bought it. And I bought the contract. You remember a guy called Andy Smithers?
Uh-huh.
He used to train horses up the West Coast. He trained for that big outfit in Toronto for a while, too, but he went back east. But I started on, he bought my contract off this Sam Bell, the straight flower stock farm. And of course, when he bought it, that was the greatest thing that ever happened to me, you know, so I could get away from them. And it was work. He lived in the tack room. The tack rooms, they had these old stalls in those days. They did for polo ponies, I guess. And they were 10 by 10, and there's dirt floors. So the first thing you did when you came in, you'd get in there and you'd run strings of wire across the top of the one you were going to make for attacking. It was just a horse's stall. They were 10 by 10, so you'd know how much room there was in that. And you'd run the wire across and put tar paper on the top, and then you'd put tar paper, try to get tar, if you had tar paper left, you'd try to put some down on the floor and some on the side of the stalls there, because the horses be, you know, they could be cracks all over there, and you get some little mare that back up there to the wall or something and relieve herself in the middle of the night, you'd be looking like you got a golden shower or something. It was pretty bad, you know, so yeah, it was rough living that way, too, and then there was no such a thing as hot water. There, I mean, we were at a place called Brighouse Park. I think there was one outhouse in the whole place, and it was a three-holer, and then there was, yeah, that was about it. I mean, it was rough living. It wasn't.
Yeah.
And so you were a man before your time, I'll tell you that. That's for sure. Yeah. So when you... Something would happen later on in life and you happen to get money, you started to appreciate it. And the jock mounts were $15. And, of course, your contract employers, you didn't get paid. So that's why they rushed you into riding, those trainers and that. They'd rush you into riding. And, I mean, I sit back and there was a lot of good horsemen, too. There was a lot of good trainers in those days. But they wouldn't leave anywhere. Like, they didn't have the horses to go to California, because you had to have a $1,600 horse to go to California to run at Bay Meadows or Tan Fran or Golden Gate. You certainly did, because they wouldn't make it if you didn't. So, and you know, the horses we were running for 700 claiming.
Yeah.
700 to 900, 1,000, 12,500. 12,500 was a logical figure. That's 1,200 and 500. But it was all different. It was all different. That's sort of another thing that I get a kick out of nowadays. They'll start running these horses now. Oh yeah, these horses got to have 2 months between races. He's got to have this. He's got to have that. Well, it wasn't only up there. I mean, we run these suckers. It was nothing for us to run the last week at the Old Willows Park. We'd run them three times or four times, as many times as we could get them in the last week. Lead them over there. I know I had an old horse called Blue Barrister when I started training horses, and that was about 1957, I guess it was, or 58, whatever, 57, I think. And I dragged him over there three times the last week of the races. And I mean, but everybody did it. I mean, because you had to get money for it, because you had a long winter. I mean, you'd be all through the end of September, so you're looking at October on to the following June before you got started again.
Right.
Unless you went away somewhere, and those horses couldn't go anywhere. They'd be turned out by the end of September. They'd all be turned out, and you'd have to catch them come April to start training, you know. So things were different, and they had some very good horsemen, too. They had guys like Jackie Russell, and of course Smithers was a good trainer, and there was trainers out there, but they wouldn't go anywhere. They wouldn't go across the street. But well, they didn't have the horses really to go anywhere, as I said, to go to those places. But they, even if they had the opportunity, because I remember when Bill Skews got to riding, and that was in probably the early 50s, he tried to get Jackie Russell, because he was kind of the kingpin in New England. And Narragansett was still big time in those days, Suffolk and Lincoln and Rockingham Park, you know, it was a good circuit. And he tried to get him to come back there. He said, hell, he said, I can't leave there. He said, but I got to be at the Legion. They'd have the Canadian Legion. So they'd have them right there, the track there. And the old trainers would be up there, and they'd sit there and lie to each other right up, you know, until the race was started the following year. But they wouldn't go anywhere. In other words, like they just wouldn't go to Calais. They wouldn't go down there and train horses. And they were some good horsemen, because, they'd done everything, been everything, and everybody, you had to do everything in those days. I mean, and in running them too.
You
went the whole 9 yards.
When the purses are so small, you've got to do a lot of the work yourself.
Well, sure.
If you're going to make any money.
Yeah, I mean, things didn't cost nothing. You know, we were eating in the kitchen. They had called them cook shacks up there, and we were eating in those places. 75 cents, I think it was, for the dinner. And so they galloped horses for a buck. I when I quit riding, I was galloping horses for a dollar a head.
Wow.
And lucky to get that, never getting $2. And then when the war was on, we were getting $5. Of course, I got in at the end of it. I got in about 44, 45, whatever, when the war was putting her over. And of course, I wouldn't get nothing. I wasn't getting nothing anyway, because I was under contract. And by the time I got through working, I think there was a the trainer and myself and another kid, and we had 12 of them, and we did everything we get through doing. We'd get through doing them up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then it was time to feed and get. And then at nighttime, there's no sticking a hose in the pail and watering them off at nighttime. You'd each do each individual pail, do every pail, and then walk from the water tap maybe 100 feet away or something to, you know, water everything again. And things were just different, and you were a man before your time. That was the whole thing.
Yeah, so when you have that situation, you don't really know the difference. I mean, it's just what you do, so
go ahead and do
what you got to do.
And you appreciate things when you finally get something, you appreciate. But the trouble is, you don't know how to handle it when you get it either. Because as soon as I got money, I mean, I had every person in the world follow me to go on for dinner and here, there, and everything else. And, you know, you. Because you're not used to money. You're not used to it.
Right.
And now finally you're getting some money. Or a small amount. I mean, you get $15 a job, about $35 for a win, you know. And the wins were far apart for me. Yeah, because I wasn't much of a writer. I was just going through the motions, you know. And it was a different way. And to this day, I really don't know what it. I see kids coming up now that make riders, and they're gentlemen, they're dressed nice, and they're clean, and they're this and that. And I mean, it was not just for us to be walking around with the same jeans and crap on for the whole year, you know, because we didn't have nothing. And so I think it's a way better environment now, naturally. I think it's way better for them. I mean, people talk about the old times, and, well, it was way better when we did it this way and we did it that way. Sure, I mean, everybody did the same thing today. Every horse that went over there was run the same way, too. I mean, it was. I mean, they had everything in them, and you went your best lick because you were. Well, when we were in Phoenix, and just kid there in Phoenix, we were at Fairgrounds and Sportsman Park in Arizona Downs. We had three racetracks in the Arizona Downs with those in Sunny Slope. That was a big time. And then we had the Fairgrounds in downtown at Six Points. They had Sportsman's Park over by County Hospital in downtown Phoenix. Then they come along and they built a whole new, they built Turf Paradise, which is way out in the desert. At those days, it was 17 miles out from downtown Phoenix. And, of course, you thought you were out in the boondocks. There was nothing out there. And they made a pretty nice little course of it out there. But the purses were $900. And we thought, oh, my God, now you're getting six. We were getting $620 to the winner. So in town, in the Fairgrounds, we were racing there, and we were getting, there were $600 purses. We were getting $290 to the winner. And it was, you'd get, if the horse finished second or third or fourth, you know, you got your money immediately. You didn't have to wait. You could go right to the bookkeeper and get your money, but it's a win. Of course, they'd hold it up for that two or three days before the test come back. And you'd be sitting there crossing your fingers hoping to come back, you know, all right. But you'd want to get that money right away so you could go and eat.
That's,
you know,
right.
So you say, Twiggy and I used to stand at the head of the lane sometime. We'd be yelling for a horse, and get beat, 30 seconds, because we'd want to go out that night. You know, go down to one of the hockey tops downtown, the cowboy bars or something, and be fools, you know, just to get out of the way from there. But everything was different. Everything was different. And, you know, and then sometimes, of course, when you finally, like when I left Arizona, I was there 10 years and I'd raced in Arizona and Long Acres. And then send some up to Vancouver sometimes. But when I went to New England, I went there and I trained for Audley Farms the first year when I went back. And I got two or three good owners right off the bat. And I thought I was in the big time at Suffolk Downs. I said, I finally made it. Finally made it. Because, you know, and of course, I was there for 10 years before I went up to Eastern Canada, to Toronto, and of course, Woodbine. That was like going to the Big A or something. That was something else.
Yeah.
So it was quite a thing for me when I finally thought I arrived at the big time and had better horses, and then of course to get back to California and be able to set up there, like you're in God's country then, and so it's been interesting. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, you used to ship a few horses down to California for the winter meet once in a while. Big Destiny and Decent Davy, a couple horses that I remember.
Well, Yeah, well, I took Big Destiny, and then I had a horse called Decent Davy I took down. And I'd go down there with one or two horses and from Ontario, from Toronto. Now, I raced in Toronto for 11 years. I raced there for 11 years. And then always would send some to New England, too, to Rockingham and places like that. And I never got many, you know. Like, I think the most I had, I might have had 20-something at one time or something, but young horses and stuff like that. And, of course, you don't get much, you know, to run. You're lucky if you get to run too many times. But and then periodically, you know, the things that happen and stuff like that. And I don't know. I feel pretty fortunate that I got, you know, things happen. I think I wind up winning 4 grade ones or something, and I win a bunch of twos and grade twos and threes and stuff. And I always seem to have some pretty nice horses that run all right, you know. So that part was all right.
And, yeah, you always lived life in relatively high style too, which is pretty much all you can ask for.
Sometimes a little too high. Well, pretty high style going through the wives I went through.
Yeah,
it was awful hard on the wives.
Well, that's a whole different show. Great. We could do that. We could do the David Cross wives show for hours on end. But but anyway,
you're not five times. I'm not proud of it. I mean, five. I'm not proud of it. I mean, I'd like to have been married once and stayed married like most people do, or well, not so much now, but I mean, but then, you know, dude, I'm going to tell you something. I know why that happened, though, because when you're a kid and you got a grade 7 education, come on, let's face it, you know, you got a grade 7 education, and then finally you start getting, not fame, but you start getting money. Well, say you start getting money. Well, goddamn, when you can, you know, roll up a roll of bills in your pocket and have a bulge there, I mean, it's something else. The first thing you ought to do is buy a pair of blue suede shoes and a big Cadillac car or something, and away you go. And that was like that. That, I think that's what it was for me. So when you get a little bit of, I will say fame, or when you get a little bit of money or something, you don't know how to handle it. Now these kids do, you know, they got people who put the money away for them and this and that and everything like that. But those days you didn't. You just spent it because it was just like, well, I don't know. You never thought of tomorrow, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
But you lived awful good that day.
We're going to step away for a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with David about his Kentucky Derby winner, Sonny's Halo. You're listening to Trainer Talk, sponsored by Fasig Tipton.
For your best chance at success, shop Fasig Tipton Selected Sales. Annually ranked at the top of all major North American sales by percentage of Grade 1 winners and graded stakes winners produced, that trend continued at the 2015 Breeders' Cup World Championships. Fasig Tipton Selected Sales grads won 6 Breeders' Cup races at Keeneland, with victories by such stars as American Pharoah, Stop Charging Maria, Songbird, Nyquist, Teppan, and Waybell Avenue. Fasig Tipton Selected Sales. Where will you be? For more information, please visit FasigTipton.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Rossi Maya. What a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
And they're off to New York, the premier state bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
David, we all know what you've given up for this horse. You've dedicated everything to him. It's paid off.
I just got it all back today. I just want to, I'm very, very happy for the people in Canada and everything, and also California and Arkansas, because without them, I wouldn't have got here now.
So. I assume it's on to the Preakness.
Yes, sir. Right quick, too.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, sponsored by Fasig Tipton. It's been an entertaining bit of the first part of the show, talking with David Cross. And if you've missed any part of it, you can listen on horseracingradio.net or download a podcast at Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. And you'll want to catch every minute of this show. It's been very entertaining. David, let's talk about Sonny's Halo now. What was it like, that feeling winning the Derby? I mean, getting ready for the show, I watched that race over and over again, and it looked like maybe on the turn he might get beat, and then, you know, he put on this great stretch kick. How confident were you, and what was it like? What was that feeling like?
Well, I think my wife summed it up the best. That was the girl. Remember the blonde girl I was married to?
Yeah, Patty.
Patty?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I had three of them that were called Patty. was Patty number two. She summed it up best when they had all the cameras going on the box, like where they put you in the box. And they had us in the box. I don't know. I don't think it was even part of the grandstand, but they had us. But nobody squawked or nothing. You just got it, and that was, you're lucky to have a place to sit or stand anyways. But she summed it up best after they got him by the wire. She says, "Now we're having fun." And just shouted out. She says, "Now we're having fun," you know. And so she summed it up. She summed it up best. And then I guess we were walking out there. And, of course, they all broke into singing "O Canada." And my wife and I were American. So, you know, but it's nice that the owners, you know, that they were, the Fosters, they were just beautiful, beautiful people. They broke into song singing "O Canada" or something like that, and I was kind of embarrassed for them for a second. Then I thought, what the hell is it? Why shouldn't they do what they, you know, they're proud of their country, blah blah blah, why not, you know?
Absolutely. And we're listening to David Cross here, if you're just tuning in on Trainer Talk, sponsored by Fasig Tipton. And that was the first time that a Canadian bred, owned and trained horse won the Kentucky Derby, right?
Yeah, because Northern Dancer was Horatio Lurl trained him, and he was from the Argentine, and Bill Hardtack rode him, and he was a thorough Canadian, because I had the mare too, you know. I owned the mare at first, and I bought her in a junk sale. I bought her in a garbage sale, Greg, of $3,900 for her, and her name was mostly Sunny, and she was the gamest thing you ever seen in your life, and she was something else. You know, she was she'd run, and then she was one of these that would lay down for a couple, 3 days. And as soon as she got up, you knew you could hit the shudder with her. You could start looking to enter her back. But she wins five or six races or something. She went run for a ham sandwich. But she was just one of those that was a hard knocking thing, and I dearly loved her. So it was getting near the end of the meet. And what I'd do, when Woodbine would start coming to an end, we'd still have a couple of weeks to race in Detroit at DRC. So Jimmy Garut, which was a dear friend of mine, I'd known him for years, and I'd always send a couple of horses down for him, and then tell him, you know, do what you want with them and get rid of them. I don't want to see their faces again. You just they're no good to me. Just get rid of them or whatever. And he would always do that and send me some money. He'd sell them to Baird, you know, the guy that is from Mountaineer Park.
Oh, yeah, Dale Baird.
And he got killed, and I think he got killed in a car accident or truck accident or something a few years ago. But he'd be the leading trainer in North America with near wins,
yeah.
I think, still.
Yeah.
So anyway, he'd R.L. Baird to come over there, or whatever
Dale Baird.
His last name was. Yeah, yeah. did come over there, and he'd always buy, so Jimmy had, I'd sell them what I had. So a funny thing happened. I got about, the van came down. It was one of Ehrlich's van. Sally wasn't up in Canada at that time. And Ehrlich's van come down, and the stall guy come down, which was a dear friend of mine, and he says, Dave, he says, the van's up here. You got anything to send? I said, yeah, I have. I said, I got, you know, because we're going over to Greenwood. In those days, we'd end on December the 15th at Greenwood to go to the racetrack that was in town from Woodbine. So I said, yeah, I got one or two to go. So anyways, I had just put the one. I don't think one could walk, so I couldn't send her across the street. So I had this mostly sunny. I said, I'll send her on now and get rid of her. So I put her on the van. And the way she went out, they went out the front gate. I had the slips for them to get out the gate and the whole bit and the papers and then the envelope and the way they went. Or the way she went. I was the only one that had on the van that time. So I came back to the tack room and I phoned Jimmy up at DRC. I said, Jimmy, I said, I got one coming in on the van. They'll be in there later on tonight. No, he said, okay, fine. He said, I run horses in the late races, so I'll be here. And he had a big outfit down there. He had 30 or 40 horses, whatever. So I sent her on down, and she was got out the gate. I got back to pack him. After I got off the phone, I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at the wall, and there's a bunch of pictures up in the wall and everything like that. I'd see her right off the bat. I said, you know, this is something, you know, I give nothing for her, and she run her eyeballs off for me and everything. And I said, why am I doing this? So I didn't phone Mr. Foster or anything. Owners never interfered with you those days either. You pretty well did what you want. They didn't have condition books, and they didn't tell you where to run them. A good one didn't tell you to run, you know, where to run them or nothing. Then they stayed away. They did their business. Like he was in the stock market business down on Bay Street, which is like, the big, you know, like being on the big street in New York, you know. So he never interfered, so I didn't phone him. You didn't have cell phones. I'd talk once a week. He'd phone me up once a week and ask me how things were. I'd say, fine, and that would be it. And how are you doing? Or something, or we'd go and eat. And so anyways, I got to say, I said, I can't do it. So I got in the car, and I went out the stable gate and went on the 401. And there was only one way to get to the border those days, and that was on the 401. Going down, you go through London and Windsor, Ontario, and then go across a big bridge there in Detroit and you go on to DRC. I'm going down the highway, and I can't see the van. I said, God damn, this guy's making big time or something on there. So finally I saw the Ehrlich's van. I saw the back part of Ehrlich's van, and I pulled up, and I started honking the horn. I got on the inside lane, and I'm honking the horn. I'm looking over at the driver, and the driver's waving at me, like I'm honking at him because I'm recognizing him or whatever. So finally, he had enough sense. He started to pull over. He says, "What's the matter, Crosby?" He says, "You got another rat to go or something like that?" And I said, "No, I got one to take back." I said, "Look, here's $100 bill." I said, "You know, you're only about 15 miles or 20 miles out of Toronto right now." I said, "Take this thing back." And I said, "If you would," I said, "I got an unloader." I said, "I'm not sending. I've changed my mind." So he found a way. He went up to the next exit or something. It went across the overpass. He came back down on the freeway on the other side and brought her back. Now, on loaders, I never even said nothing to her. I never said it to Foster. A couple of weeks later, I might have mentioned something. I brought that mirror back, you know, because I told him I was going to send her down and get rid of her. So that was it. And we bred her, and I had a nice foal by Regal Horse of Winfield. Real good horse called Regal something, his name was. He was a good sire. And I sent him down to a guy in Florida to break and get ready, and because I thought quite a bit about him. He's a nice big colt. He stood almost 16 hands to the two-year-old, going into his two-year-old year. And anyway, to make a long story short, he broke his shoulder down there, so he didn't. Then the mare came up, she miscarried. Then she came up with twins or something. They pitched one off. The other one never made it. So she was about 5 or 6 years and never got in full. By that time, I'm training 3 or 4 horses for Winfield Farm. Frankie Merrill Jr., he had 4 or 5 for them, I should say, the majority of them. They didn't have one trainer those days. He had about 4 or 5 trainers, and I had about 3 for them. So I got friends with the big shot that was the farm manager, the manager, Joe Thomas. And he was from Kentucky originally. And him and I were pretty good friends, and they'd send out their vet every Sunday to do your vet work and everything. And so I got to talk to him. I said, you got a horse called Halo. I said, standing in Maryland. I said, any chance of breeding? Or he says, for you, Dave? He says, yeah. He says, we'll get you. I got to breed to Halo for $4,000.
Nice.
And so anyways, the mare foaled. And thank God everything was all right with it. Now, she's gone 5 or 6 years and missed and twins and aborted and the whole bit. And finally got a live foal, and it was him. And so Mr. Foster said, come, it was getting up near January the 1st and going to this two-year-old year. And I said, you better, you know, everything named, because I'd start off, I'd have a lot of two-year-olds starting off and everything. I had about 15 or 16 two-year-olds, I guess. And oh, he says, that's right, too. So he named her right during trip, between Christmas and New Year's or something. He phoned New York. He had to phone New York those days. And so he had sent in a couple of names, and they'd been turned down. He turned that, remember the good, what was the good football, the good player that used to play
Sonny Jurgensen?
Pittsburgh. No, the guy's name was, he had a nickname. He tried to name him, but of course he couldn't name him after a celebrity because the guy wouldn't okay it. He got a hold of him and the guy wouldn't phone him.
Yeah, the NFL.
The guy wouldn't let him name the horse after him. So anyways, I'll think of it before it's over. Anyways, they couldn't get that. So the woman says to him, he said, well, I see it's out of Mostly Sunny. And he says, yeah, by Halo. He said, why do you call it Mostly Sunny? He says, hey, you know, he said, I was just thinking of that. You know, Mr. Foster was kind of calming. He said, I was just thinking of that. So that was, he says, I didn't give much thought to the name. He says, here, Mostly, that was the mare, because her name was Mostly Sunny. And he said, that was how he came up with the name Sunny's Halo. And so that was it. And all the two-year-olds I had that year, we used to break them in the fall. We used to break them in the fall year at Woodbine. In those days, we were allowed to break them in the fall year, so I had a bunch to break. And I used to get on a lot of my own horses those days and breeze them and stuff like that. But we'd get to breeze them in December while we were at Greenwood Racetrack before Greenwood was over. We'd breeze them already at Woodbine at the training track. They'd keep the training track open all winter those days. They'd keep them open all year. They'd throw calcium and salt on it all night long, work the tracks all night long, the training track. And so a lot of horses would stay right at Woodbine. So I was racing in New York those days, and I'd send a half a dozen to New York. And I kept him back. I didn't send him down or send him anywhere or back to the farm. I left him at the racetrack. I had 20 of them there at the racetrack. I left him there. And, of course, I'd just fly down to New York when I was running something and then get out of there because so cold up there in the wintertime anyways, and go out to Woodbine, and we'd have the barns all covered up, you know, we'd have them all canvassed in and everything like that. And that, so he set the winter right there, and I never let him off the way. But a funny thing happened. Dr. Fishman was working for me, a veterinarian, a real good veterinarian called Dr. Donnie Fishman, and he was working for me. So he come down the show, he said, what have we got to cut? I said, cut every one of the colts. I'd cut them all. And they're Canadian bred, so, you know, who would ever think of leaving them as a stallion? You know, Winfields, they would, you know, or something, some of theirs, because they were pretty good. You know, they're pretty out of good mares and everything like that. Here's a mare that come out of a garbage sale, and I get the Halo for $4,000. And I'm thinking, I said, cut them all. So that morning, he had gone over a walk. He'd been in the walker machine and had the plastic. I had two walker machines out in front of my barn there. Frankie Merrill and I had the whole barn together. And I had this two walker machines out front and had that, like an Irish rail going around the outside of it. And he got his foot over top of it and cut himself all up between his hind leg. And I mean, tore up there real good. And so I said, we'll have to miss this one. I said, there's eight to cut. I said, do seven of them. I says, those other ones, I said, snatch them out of there. And I says, but this, we'll have to leave this. We'll leave the chestnut. We'll leave that, the big chestnut colt. And he was big at that time. He was a good 16 hand, almost 16, even 16 hands, I think. That's a two-year-old. So I says, leave him. I says, we won't do him. So anyways, we didn't. And I wind up, after he got the going, and he was doing so good. He had breathed fabulous in December. He had, you know, milk breeze to all my other babies and stuff like that. And because we'd get about two, three breezes in them in December before people would turn them out or leave them, or lay them up for the rest of the winter. So he stayed that way, and I just got lucky that I didn't cut him, because I mean, I come within an inch of cutting him. If he doesn't go over the outside rail, the rail on the Walker machine a few days before, I would have he'd have been cut too.
Yeah,
they'd been gone. They'd have been thrown on top of the roof of the barn.
That's amazing.
That would have been him.
Yeah,
would have been him up on the roof of the barn.
A lot of serendipity in this story, huh? Things just seem to be working out good.
Oh,
and then his two-year-old year was unbelievable. I mean, the Coronation Futurity, the Gray Stakes, the Collins Stakes, the Swinford Stakes. I mean, that's all the races you can win in Canada, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Well, he was a two-year-old champion of the year that year. He was a two-year-old of the year in Canada. And I didn't stay for the Cup and Saucer. I didn't stay for the Cup and Saucer because I made a mistake that to this day I'm kicking my rear end over. I sent him to Laurel for the Laurel for Charity, and I shouldn't have. My races at those days, they were 2 weeks apart all the way, 2 weeks, boom, boom, boom. So you ran horses in 2 weeks. I mean, now they want to give them, the trainer won't run them unless it's 2 months between races or something, you know,
right.
But they can get away with it, I guess. I don't know. Who knows whether our way was better? Maybe the horses were a better breed of horses. Maybe they were stronger horses in those days or something. I don't know. Maybe the racetracks were kinder to them. It's hard to say. But I sent him to Laurel, and I shouldn't have run him to Laurel for Charity, and he didn't run any good. And then instead of coming right back and bringing the horse back to Canada, I sent the horse on to Jersey and run him in the Young America, and I'd breathe him over there at nighttime between the Futurity and everything. I'd breathe him at nighttime too under the lights, so it wasn't bad enough, but he just ran horrible. So I came back and I had a decision to make. What am I going to do? So my wife's bugging me. She was a California girl and she wanted to get back to Arcadia. She wanted to get back to California. I was going out there anyways, because I would, even if I sent something else out, I was going out anyways. And I thought, I'm going to send. I don't know what it is. I said, I got to send this horse out. So even then, I was in. He was been injected. He'd been injected maybe three or four different times, I guess, at that time, because I had a terrible ankle on him, and he wasn't a sound horse at all. Anyways, I put him on the airplane and I sent him out to California, and I couldn't go for. That was about a month before I could go yet. I couldn't go. So I sent him out there, and it was the best thing I did when I sent him out there. And I sent him out, and Jesse Newsom, a trainer called Jesse Newsom, he's dead now. He's a boy from Texas, a good trainer, and they had run a beautiful outfit and everything. And you remember him, Newsom?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Jesse?
Yeah,
he wore the cowboy clothes and the cowboy hat.
Right. He looked like a page out of the Old West.
You got it. He'd walk into Clown Town, and my God, he was the talk of the town in Clown Town.
Yeah,
a good-looking kid, and he just but he was fine. He did a good job training and everything like that. So I sent the horse out to him, and because he had had Big Destiny or something else for me for a while out there too, and Decent Davey or something else he'd had for me. So I sent the horse out there to him, and I didn't see him for a month. Then my wife and I got in the car. I think a couple of days before Christmas, and we drove back to California. And of course, we were both happy to get back there anyways, and she was a California girl. And the racetrack was horrible that winter at Santa Anita. It was just horrible. So it come the 1st of January, and my cousin was over at Hollywood Park with a few horses. And he said, why don't you come over to Hollywood? I said, I don't want to go over that joint. I said, I really don't want to go over there, blah, blah, blah. But I said, I got to get out of here. I said, Roving Boy broke down. Remember Roving Boy broke down that winter?
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
And he was going to be one of the favorites for the plate, or for the plate, for the derby.
Yeah.
And he had broke down, and three or four others had broke down, and the track was just a sea of mud, and it was just horrible. So come January the 1st, Terry and them came over with a one-horse trailer, this crickety old trailer, and we loaded it in, and along they went, and I followed them along the expressway. And I was staying at Anita's, what was that condominium name? Right on the corner of Colorado and Anita's something it was called.
Oh, I can't remember.
It was a condominium. I was staying there. So anyways, we moved over. We moved to the Cockatoo. That was a great move. They moved the cockatoo over at Hollywood Park, and I got the horse over there in my cousin's barn. I would go over there, but I'd still stayed in the place for a couple of weeks. Then I moved over there to the hotel. We both moved over to the hotel, and I had this. I kept Arkansas because I'd raced in Arkansas. I'd wintered there one winter. My horses weren't good enough to go into New Orleans for the fairgrounds, so I wintered it there. I loved it in Arkansas. So anyways, I kind of said, you know, I can get this horse ready by March. So it started back galloping in January. And I used the pool at Hollywood, and that's when they named the pool, the Sunny Fela pool, and Mark Devitt, he called it after the horse.
Yeah, so after he won the Derby, they hopped on the bandwagon.
Yeah, she did. But she was pretty good. She was pretty good to me, though, actually.
She's a great lady.
We got the horse going, but he didn't swim as much as people said. Everybody said they made it like the horse came right out of a pool and went into the Derby or went into the Rebel, you know, and then the Arkansas Derby and stuff. But he didn't, because you swim too much and they build muscle where they shouldn't. They get funny behind. They get real funny behind. Like, I know I went away and I had to go back east. I think I still had a couple of New York, I guess, but I had to go back east, and I was gone for about 5 days. And Terry, my cousin, he kept swimming. I mean, he didn't know, you know. And I guess I hadn't said, you know, not to keep swimming. But we had the horse up to swimming about 40 minutes a day. We had him up swimming, I think, about 40 minutes a day by that time, and he swam him for about 5 days straight. So when he come back, I got on him. I was getting on him myself in the mornings, and. So I got on him and went out there to the training track at Hollywood Park, and out there with 80 million yearlings and everything else, horses going this way, that way, and blah, blah, blah. And now, I haven't breezed him either at that time yet. This is February, and I still haven't breezed him. And he felt like he has 10 legs. I mean, he just was horrible. Just kept switching leads and boom, boom. I said, oh, my God. So it's like a baby coming out. You've had babies with buck shins that have come off the buck shins, and when they're breaking those little adhesions, you know, from their shins healing up, they're worse than they were before they bucked, you know, when they started to buck. And this is how he felt. Just, hello.
Hello. So,
are you there? I'm sorry, Jude. I didn't know whether you were still there or not.
I'm just fascinated anyways, listening to the training schedule.
Anyways, he was just horrible. So when I came back, he says, "Man," I said, "I don't know whether it's the swimming or not." And I said, "It could be the swimming." I said, "He just feels terrible behind." So I jogged him for about 3 or 4 days, and finally he started feeling like his old self underneath me, which still wasn't 100% even then, because the horse was always funny, because he had had these shin splints all the way down. They were worse than the ankle, actually, the shin splints, because they'd break, like they'd be like the adhesions tearing on there a little bit too. So he was always a little bit, like you'd point at his shin and he'd boom, you know, this and that. But I had an x-ray, and I think I brought Harthill, Dr. Harthill. I think he'd come up there for one of Mayberry's horses or something, and I'd got a hold of him, and he'd looked at me and said, "Dave," he said, he's got some little adhesions there, but he says, "Don't worry about it." You know, even a little time yet, he said, "Don't worry about it," you know, blah, blah, blah. So anyways, I went on with him, but there was always a bit of a non-soundness to the horse. Not enough that you would stop, Jude, but there was enough that you would be concerned, you know, all the time. So that was always on the back of your mind with the horse. But anyways, I got lucky on a flight. Sutton came in and with the plane, and Mel Prince was on there. And of course, Mel Prince had been a friend of mine. I knew Mel. Mel knew me from the time I was a kid. So, because he had rode out west when he was trying to ride. And he came out there and he said, I'll get you on the plane. And I think we had our meeting in Clown Town. He said, I'll get you on the plane. So I bought him a few more drinks, and I was on the plane before we left out of there. But he bounced a horse out of there or something, and whatever it was, some saddlebred that was going back to Kentucky. And I got on there, and they dumped me off in Arkansas, and then the plane went on to Bluegrass. But I was fortunate in a lot of spots there. Just everything just fell into place. And then, And I guess the one that opened my eye, you know, well, you know the training track. It was, I don't even know if it was a half mile. The one in Hollywood?
Yeah, it was. I think it was a half mile, but it was a great surface to train a horse on.
But it was just a half a mile. I'll tell you that because I rode it. They were all half miles when I rode, you know. It might have been a half mile. But anyways, Georgie Gubbins was a clocker there, and I got to breeze. The guy, the stall man there, he was the head of the track. He wouldn't open up the main track at Hollywood, and then they had the 2-year-old sales there. Remember they had the 2-year-old sales there in the spring.
Right.
So it was coming into March, and they still wouldn't open up. So I had to breeze him, and I breezed him 5/8 of a mile on the training track one day. I got my irons jacked up. I rode with a 6-inch iron anyways, and I got them jacked up. This thing, I broke him off, and he had to be as straight as a string. I parked him in the middle of the racetrack because there was no way that I could make the turns with him. And Gubbins, the clocker Sam, was up on the turn at that time, right, which would be your 7/8 pull on the mile track. It was up on the turn. And I broke this horse off at the head of the lane. And away, he started running at the head of the lane, and I got him parked out in the middle of the racetrack. And when I went into the bottom turn, I didn't think that he was going to make this. No way that he was going to make the turn. And I got a wrap on him. I got both my feet right up by his ears. Well, they're not that far, but I mean, I got him in front of me. I couldn't get. I was just as straight as a string on him. And anyways, Georgie come running back to the barn, so I got him pulled up. Eventually, I got him pulled up. At the bottom of the backside again. By the time I got him pulled up, so I bring him back in the barn, and I looked at Terry and I said, "Jesus Christ!" I said, "This horse is something else." I said, "I can't believe it! I can't believe it!" I said, "I don't know how fast he went, but I said this horse is running." Anyways, he had gone in a minute and change, and he had gone out the 3/4 in 13, and pulled up the 7/8 in 25/4. Now that's Georgie Gubbins. That's him on, and this is set up in the middle of the racetrack on that half mile racetrack.
Wow.
So I thought, well, I'm Arkansas bound, I'll tell you. So if everything's all right, so the next I get, I'm tens and knees. I can't wait to get from the hotel to the track at 5:00 the next morning. And I've been down there that night, and everything looked good. He had cleaned up his feet. At 9:00, his feet was all laid up and everything. And I thought, oh my God, just stay, because the plane was leaving the following week. I think it was because I got to breeze him once at Hollywood on the main track once. Time I got to breathe. That was the only time I got onto the track, and that's when this guy opened the track up. The guy's name was Johnson, something Johnson. His name was. He had been a hockey player up in Canada or something, and he was a stall man. And he finally had opened up, and so I got to breeze the horse once at Hollywood, and I think Joel Mena he breezed the horse for me, and he got off, and he said, "Oh my God!" So. When I went into Arkansas, I was pretty confident going into the Rebel. And it was run, I think, 3 weeks. I was there 3 weeks before the Rebel, and everything worked. And I think I got the breeze him once at Arkansas too. So he was more than ready when he run in the Rebel, you know. So as I said, every race was 3 weeks apart. The Rebel to the Arkansas Derby, 3 weeks to Arkansas Derby, the Kentucky Derby. It was 3-3-3, and it just. Everything just fell right into place.
Well, David, I can't believe the hour's flown by. We got to do another hour. I've got your phone number now. I'm going to call you back. We're going to do another hour. I didn't even get to half the stuff I wanted to talk to you about. But we really appreciate your taking the time with us today.
Us old timers, sometimes we start ranting on and we can't stop. That's the only thing we can talk about.
It was great. Really appreciate it. Just a reminder, if you've missed any portion of this show, you can listen to the podcast at horseracingradio.net or download it at Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. For our producer, Lee Della Pina, this is Jute Feld. Thanks for listening. Are you still there? David?
What I want to do. What's your email, Jude?
It's main guy, M-A-N-E-G-U-Y.
Wait, okay.
M-A-N-E.
M-A-N-E.